So is God green? Well, that is the question for this lunchtime. We actually stand at a moment in the long history of the universe, the Earth, and humanity, where it seems like we are rapidly approaching an environmental crisis. Homo sapiens, at numerous points time over, have faced famine, fire, and flood, and plague. And these occurrences right now are pretty raw for those of us who are Australian, right? Throughout history, some people groups have found a way through. Others, well, sadly, little memory or even no evidence remains of their existence and actually what they may have faced. It's pretty tragic. We see significant environmental concerns looming increasingly large, don't we, and prevalent in our media streams, in our conversations, in our classrooms. The alteration of the climate, air pollution, soil contamination, global toxification, deforestation, overmining, landfill, plastic oceans, melting ice caps, species diversity, species survival, human and cultural degradation, and in it all, sustainability. It can kind of be hard to know exactly how to feel about the world that we inhabit right now. I'm struggling a bit, and I'm no expert. A recent ABC article said this. A report written by Paul Gilding, a fellow of the University of Cambridge Institute for Sustainability Leadership, and commissioned by the Breakthrough National Centre for Climate Restoration, put forward the view that there is a high likelihood of human civilization coming to an end in 2050 if action is not taken to curb climate change. Wow. And Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth, from his famous documentary, is basically there's a global catastrophe coming. It might be bad, we might be able to do something about it, if we're not too late. Now, I don't know how much of those sentiments you might share in our current proposed environmental crisis, whether you are worried or complacent, anxious, apathetic, confident, resigned, agreed, or skeptical. I kind of think I might not be as concerned as I should be. I'm still working that one out. But there is, and I feel it, an unease about the current state of affairs, right? We have different reactions to the reality that you, me, us in this room, and students around the campus are the ones who actually might live the day after tomorrow. Experience I Am Mother play out. Have Wall-E move from fictional animation to being our live action story. To be those who are in Waterworld. Anyone know that one? Yeah, one person. It's a 95 movie, by the way. But this is the difference, right? That's the big thing. Compared to human scenarios that have played out in the past. It's a bit doomsday, isn't it, what we're hearing? Apocalyptic. It's being presented as final, the end. Not just for a local region, but actually game over for all. Or if it's not quite, there then seems to be some promise of maybe entering a dystopia or significantly difficult and different world in the future, which I don't think seems too much to hope for. And so that might lead you, it certainly leads me, to inquire, whatever your kind of backdrop belief might be, where is God, at least the Christian God, where is he in all that's going on? Particularly in the last 200 years with the Industrial Revolution. And where might he be in 2050, hey? What's he up to? Where is he? Does he care? Well, our ecological and conservational issues are important to God, actually more so than us. You might find that surprising. Is he acting to address all these green and kind of earthly things? Very much so, actually. So let's begin to look at how so and what that might mean for our present situation and our future as well. Well, to start with, as we kind of think about this question, as Eve said before, we're not asking literally what is the colour of God. Is he green, blue, rainbow, translucent maybe? But green as association with nature, earth, environment, that kind of thing, right? And so we're not asking if God would side more with the Greens and share their political agenda. It's not, is God a greenie or not? Neither are we seeing what kind of green words might apply to God. Like, I guess, he is sustainable because ontologically he's eternal. Or I guess he is a clean and renewable energy because he's spiritually pure, holy, and powerful. Not that kind of thing. But by green, we'll be looking at what is God's relationship to the environment, to the stork and the cedar, to the goat and the mountaintop, to the turtle and to the reef, to the lion and her pride land, men, women, children in our homes, in our homeland, and our home planet, and the sun, the moon, and the stars that swirl around us. Getting that will actually help us with his character, yes, but more so a perspective on the ecological and conservation issues at hand. Now, a way forwards to address those won't be teased out here. And what precisely a faith or human response to this may or might not look like isn't going to be tackled. But I hope it will begin to set the trajectory to kind of open that conversation wherever we may stand in regard to the answer of this question. So let's have a look at the Bible as this gives us God's story. I've got passages here that I'll read, so you don't need to worry too much about looking them up yourself. Let's look at what he said and what he's done, as that will give us a clear, definite answer on this, okay? So my first point is the way God made it, creation. And then a few sub-points under that. Is it possible, Kathleen, could you just turn the air conditioner off? Would that be like? Thanks. If you guys are getting too hot, let me know. I'm getting blown a bit here. And cold. Okay, so first little sub-point there under the way God made it is the earth is God's. The Bible's Genesis or startings opens with this. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. God saw that the light was good, and he separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. And then the days actually go on. And then later on, the Bible songwriter David, reflecting on Genesis, the beginning, chapter 1, sums it up by composing this first verse of Psalm 24. The earth is the Lord's, and everything in it, the world and all who live in it. He founded it upon the seas and established it upon the water. The story God shares with us is that all that is around, above and below, is made by him. He is the creator. This is his creation. He rules it, sustains it, controls it, owns it in all its immensity and its minutia, its diversity and its unity, its balance and its beauty. Put together intimately and intricately, mysteriously and simply. The earth was not actually fashioned out of what pre-existed. It didn't kind of explode into being by logical impossibility in a mysterious, random chaotic self-birth. Neither was it kind of accidentally spawned by some cosmic malevolence or mistake. This creation story, unlike others, and maybe yours, has an architect, a builder, a landscaper, an interior designer, a gardener, an environmental scientist par excellence. Because God owns the universe, there's actually nowhere we can go. There's nowhere that doesn't belong to him. There is nowhere anyone or anything can kind of step off his property. Nowhere we can drop off the grid, perhaps, and kind of be self-sustaining in private autonomy. And there's nowhere we can wander into some other deity's territory. He, as owner, is responsible for it. The humanities, governments, and our own zeal actually ultimately is not, because it's not ours. So next little sub-point is the earth is good. So what we see is after each stage of completing creation, God actually says it's good. And at the conclusion in Genesis 1:31, at the beginning, the end of the first chapter of the Bible, he sums up by declaring it very good. The earth has worth because God declares it does, is by saying it's good. You see, God values creation because he's the source of all value. Molecules and mice and mountains and the mesosphere and Mercury and the M10 globular cluster take their worth and their meaning from God. He's given it to them as their maker and owner, and they reflect his goodness being what they are, and they sit under the guard of his divine sovereignty. And as their creator and sustainer, he loves it. If you read on to day 7, God downtools, steps back, rests from his labor, pleased by it, delighting in the work of his green fingers. You see, matter, this matter, matters to God. It's not to be devalued by holding it as bad or dirty, as if it can kind of contaminate you or make you unclean. Undervalued by believing it is just kind of neutral or trivial. Yeah, it's just stuff, simply stuff. Or to be overvalued, to be spiritualized or divinitized, like it's kind of an extension of God or some kind of entity in itself, like Gaia or Mother Earth. So next, we start to see that actually the earth glorifies God. Creation itself is on about the praise of God and shows his magnificence and his splendor. Let me read to you from another of David's songs that he composed, Psalm 19. He says, "The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they display knowledge. There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard. Their voice goes out into all the earth. Their words to the end of the world." And from Isaiah chapter 6, the book we're looking at this semester, at the appearing of God, the seraphim, it's like, kind of like an angel, declares the same reality. "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of his glory. Heaven and earth see it." I wonder if we acknowledge it. Those same molecules, mice and mountains and the mesosphere and Mercury and the M10 globular cluster announce God exists. God is good. God is great. God is present. And God cares. The earth beckons everything join in the praise of God. It actually shuns and it shies away from any worship offered to it. All creatures, great and small, are actually made for more, according to this account. Ever wondered what the earth itself has to say about this creation? About this question? Well, it's actually already given its answer, and it continues to, moment by moment, whether God is green or not. And so what about us? Well, fourthly, from the way God made it, we see that the earth has a special and central place for me, he, she, humanity, all of us. Let me read to you from another part of Genesis here. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock of all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground." God's gracious gift to humanity and humanity's place within God's purposes is that he creates humanity in his own image. That means that we actually have a special relationship to God, which is different to the duck and the daisy and the crab and the cave. And we also have a special relationship to the earth itself. We have a God-given authority over the earth, under God, to govern, manage and lead it. A stewardship. Male and female are equal complementary partners placed in a position of honor and responsibility to add to the fullness of all the earth, to spread out and find ourselves throughout it all to bring about its flourishing. And then just following, in the next chapter, we start to see what that kind of stewardship looks like as God plants a garden for Adam. He places it in it to till and keep it, just like a tenant giving care of all that is green. And we see the responsible and sustainable use and maintenance of creation under God. It's actually precisely what so many of us want and work for. It's a beautiful picture of the world as it should be. Creation and humanity in right relationship with their creator and with each other. And Adam and Eve even enjoy God's presence as they take a stroll with him in the cool of the night. So from the way God made it, we see that the earth is good, the earth is God's, the earth is good, the earth glorifies God, and the earth has a special and central place for humanity. And so we see from the beginning, God is certainly green, isn't he? And his greenness has plenty to say to us. Three quick implications about humanness and environmental care. First, we're not to exploit the earth. Taking the environment for granted and destroying it actually dehumanizes ourselves, damages the earth, and makes you less green than God. And we're not to use creation at all. Leaving the creation totally alone is actually not what God instructed. It was never meant to be untouchable. It actually goes against a direct brief from God. It actually damages the earth and seeks to be greener than God himself. And both mistakes are harmful towards God and actually a breach of care on our part. And the animals and the trees and me are actually less for it. And so the third little point here as well, implication, is enjoy God's world. Humanity is, in the creation story, entrusted with something amazing, something wonderful, something God loves. It's like an amazing gift. So delight in it. Drink deeply of it. Get into it and out to it. You are part of the greatest wildlife show on earth. It's awesome. Now, today we know that the world, as it should be, as we have pictured here, doesn't match with our reality, right? So, what's happened? Has it been the rise of certain groups with their ideologies, capital, industry leaders, politicians, us as consumers, certain greedy nations, maybe the 1%, we who are the privileged? Well, everything changed in the next act of the story. Let's have a look at that. Second point is what we did to it, the fool. Now, I don't have time to read the next part of the story. You can catch the action and the tragedy in Genesis chapter 3, but I'll summarize. It starts with what must have been God's heart breaking as he sees how his word and his world has been handled. He says to Eve, "What have you done?" Adam and Eve had not listened to God, disobeyed him, and sought to take charge of their life on earth the way that they wanted. They reject God's purposes, and the result is that all the right relationships that humanity has becomes corrupt. Humanity's relationship with God is fractured, resulting in death. Male and female relationships are dislocated, resulting in strife. Humanity's relationship with the earth is thrown out of sync. And instead of a synergy with the land and comfortable and safe relationships with the animals, it's just now very difficult and dangerous. The ground is cursed because of man's fall. All's out of order, right? Instead of harmony, we now have toil, strife, and conflict. Our stewardship has become a mixed bag. We've created a patchwork of garden and wasteland. Humanity is ignoring our creaturely limits, and we use the earth with greed rather than care. The degradation signals that we're observing suggest that we are actually pressing the infinite limits, the finite limits, rather, that God has set for creation. The results of the path that we've chosen is seen on a daily basis, isn't it? Disease, famine, drought, earthquakes, tsunamis, throw the rest in. It's just not as it should be. And I wonder whether you feel that. Something is not right. And at the heart of this is that humanity's image is marred. It's blemished by the selfishness that we choose in its place. The us as godness that has created a ticking time bomb for us. We stand in the wrong with God, and so one another and the earth. And that's what it is for people made in the image of God to stop acting in the image of God. When we rule the way we think is wrong or right, despite what God says. And that's actually what the Bible calls sin. And that's the root of our problem when it comes to trying to run and rule our planet. And that's actually what sits behind the state of our eco and conservational challenges. And sadly, no amount of worthwhile environmentally friendly acts are going to actually fix this root problem and restore that original green colour. I can stop animal cruelty, sure, by eliminating it. But I can't fix the heart of selfish exploitation that would choose to use something within our stewardship for our own gain at its expense. I can't eco-warrior that. I know that doesn't sound great, and a bit like we are, well, are we actually doomed and destined for ruin? How green is God in all this mess? Has he bailed? Has he backed right away? Has he just kind of written the whole thing off?
Well, what follows is the story of God's eco-action to actually fix the problem. So let's have a look at what he's done about it. Salvation and reconciliation. Now we'll fast forward to the key solution. This comes in Jesus Christ, who brings salvation for humanity and reconciliation of creation and full and final renewal of all things. Now I've got a significant paragraph from one of Paul's letters to read you. It's from Colossians. And he writes, "He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For by him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authority. All things were created by him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he's the head of the body, the church. He's the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have the supremacy. For God was pleased to have his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross." Here we see God become a human. Jesus, the creator, taking creation upon himself. Jesus, the image of God, enters our chaos and our corruption. The green God sharing our greenness. And Jesus came to fix the heart of humanity by restoring that fractured relationship with God and restoring the fractured relationship between the creation under our stewardship. Jesus succeeds where Adam's image, humanity's faltered, you see. He listened, he obeyed, and he ruled rightly. Yet, he tastes the curse of death as he's hung on a tree with a crown of thorns and enters the dust of the earth and dread of judgment that was actually reserved for us. All so that we could be forgiven that root problem. See? And that's actually our deepest ecological need. Whoever you are, I want to argue that you'll best serve your environmental causes by first addressing this. As that environmental crisis is met, it will actually profoundly change our contribution to current ones that we face. But there's more to God's eco-action. In Jesus dying on a cross, God was reconciling everything to himself. That includes the created world and the environment. Jesus died for the environment. I don't know if you realize that. Matter matters to God, yeah? The cross meets more than just our need. It meets the need of creation to be liberated from frustration. Now, reconciliation means making right. It's putting back all that is around, above and below into its proper place. Putting the order back together and making the world once again as it should be. And as we look at that passage, this isn't just a local environmental impact or action. Neither is it global. It's actually cosmic. We see, don't we, that God hasn't finished with the work of his hands. I find that amazing. So, well, where's he taking this? Well, let's have a look at that lastly in the last 5 minutes. So we've seen the way God made it in creation, what we did to it in the fall, what he's done about it in salvation and reconciliation. Now, where is he taking it? Taking it to renewal. This is where this green movement is heading. Let me read to you from Isaiah, a passage that shows this connection to Jesus and what the future of the world actually is going to look like. Isaiah 11 says, "A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From his roots a branch will bear fruit. I love that kind of cool creation-y language there. That's fun. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and of power, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord. He will not judge by what he sees with his eyes or decide what he hears with his ears, but with righteousness he will judge the needy. With justice he will give decisions for the poor of the earth. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, with the breath of his lips. He will slay the wicked. Righteousness will be his belt, and faithfulness the sash around his waist. The wolf will live with the lamb, and the leopard will lie down with the goat. The calf and the lion and the yearling together, and a little child will lead them. The cow will feed with the bear. The young will lie down together, and the lion will eat straw like the ox. The infant will play near the hole of the cobra, and the young child put his hand into the viper's nest. They will neither harm nor destroy on all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. This is the picture of when all the things are reconciled. Then John, later on, in the book of the Bible, in the last book of the Bible, gets a glimpse, another glimpse of what this future day will look like. And it's actually one that is the same as how the book of Isaiah actually ends. And John says, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more." What we see here and from other passages is that on the last day there'll be a drastic break from all that is wrong in the world. So much so that the renewed world, an upcycled world perhaps, can only be described as new. What the earth is waiting for is a massive, radical act of God to transform it and to heal it, to make it a place in which the Apostle Peter can accurately describe it as a new earth, where righteousness is at home, that in the rightness is what life is like. In the beginning of the Bible, we saw that God created the heavens and the earth. Now at the end of the story, a new heavens and new earth. It's the restoration of God's original purposes in Genesis 1, yeah? No death, no tears. The old order of things simply won't be found. God is there with his people who live on the renewed earth. Now, I like the sound of that. And I want that green life and that green future. I wonder what your current and future vision is for the world and your place in it. We'll all have an opinion and a position on this. But doesn't this outlook, this one here, give hope and actually keep us from despair? Give a new and refreshed perspective as we move towards that 2050 and actually beyond. Now, with both the beginning and this end in mind, I want to come into land with three quick implications to close. First, we're actually not to do nothing. Many of us probably have been going along under the impression that creation is maybe going to be thrown in the scrap heap, or maybe just it's going to implode into kind of like a nothingness. So who cares what happens? We can disregard it, we can neglect it and be apathetic towards it, right? That seems consistent. But God isn't going to roll up this heaven and this earth like an artwork that you're not happy with and then throw it away and just start over. This actually simply isn't what the Bible says. This creation, this one, the one we're on and we're sitting in and we're eating from, it has a future and it's included in God's purposes. By caring about it now, we're naming that reality and we're protecting that. And we're showing this truth off to the world. Secondly, we're not to do everything. We're not the ones who will restore the planet. That's God's job in Jesus. we can't bring this world closer to the new creation or draw this new creation into the now. That can't happen by planting trees and mining sustainably and being an advocate and activist on everything green to secure permanent change from our governments or our friends or groups or whatever it may be. That's just not any more possible than we can bring our bodies closer to resurrection bodies by simply working on our fitness. No, the redemption of our bodies and of creation, it's God's work, and it will happen in the future in that radical break that we've just been talking about. Thirdly, we are to be something. Let me challenge you to change your mind actually on what it is to be truly human, to be an authentic image bearer. Let me invite you to have your heart changed by God to love him, because then you'll love what God loves, people on the planet, and you'll value creature and creation like he does. You'll desire the cultivation of his glory, and that will start to exercise and, in the right stewardship, take up again a responsible and sustainable use and maintenance of creation. One, I think, that will actually strike a balance for conservation and preservation in the order and the disorder of our current world here. So, is God green? Well, from beginning to end, yes. So much so that he actually gave his life for creation and creature. He is actively and passionately working for the good and the renewal of his creation, isn't he? Our environmental concerns, our complexities and our troubles, as well as our appreciation, our wonder and enjoyment of the earth, finds its source, its solution and its ongoing best practice for its care from Jesus, to whom actually belongs the whole earth and everything in it. Any questions? Just take a moment and pop your hand up. If there's none, that's absolutely fine. Yeah, Mikey.
So there seems, in Australia at least, and in some other countries, a connection between Christianity, conservative political parties, and scepticism around the importance of human's negative impact on the environment, so questioning anthropogenics, climate change, and these kinds of things. If all you said is true, how has that happened, that Christians are associated then with an opposition or a conservatism about these things?
Yeah, I think probably what might have happened is the good intention to talk and focus on, let's say, the Christian aspect of the cross and the need for people to be saved, to know God, has maybe become so all-consuming that it's shrunk the understanding that the cross is more than just dealing with us. And so that then, I think, has led to an out-of-proportional view of when it comes to like matter and creation and that kind of thing. So I think when you have a better understanding of the cross and its and what Jesus is doing there, that will help you go, oh, hang on a second, I need to consider this and think about what's happening there. So I think there's that side of things. And I think also it's maybe a misstep, which I would resist, where again the Christian message is just, and the application of the what's called the gospel, the good news, is only reduced to the Christian life and their relationship with God and the Christian community, and that's all. And actually go, no, the good news is not just good news for people, it's the good news for the whole world. And in Isaiah it's pretty cool, because there's a moment where it says, and you'll go out with joy, and the trees and the mountains or whatever will clap their hands, and that's, you know, that's kind of personification, but it's a cool picture of creation celebrating in the work and salvation of God.
So I think those kind of groups actually need to think harder about this stuff, and they need to recover this side and apply it, because I don't think they're helping. Good, great. Well, come and grab me in a minute. I'll hand over to Eve to just wrap.